This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hey, Gilbert. Hey, Frank. Bob Saget here, just telling you congratulations on your 200th episode. Gilbert, I remember when you had your first episode and I gave you some medication and you were fine. But I just love you guys, you know, in the way that a taller man can love a slightly shorter men. Congrats. 200 episodes is not a small thing. I'll show you a small thing next time I see you. Lots of love. Or whatever.
It's Chevy Chase here. Congratulations. Oh, Gilbert, I love you. And Frank, on your 200th podcast. Sure glad I wasn't on any of them.
Hey, Gilbert, it's Weird Al Yankovic. I do the parody songs. You've had me on the show. You might remember. I wanted to congratulate you on 200 episodes. Wow! Oh man, that's impressive.
Hi, I'm Gilbert Gottfried, and this is Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast with my co-host, Frank Santopadre. We're once again recording at Nutmeg with our engineer, Frank Verderosa.
Yay, Frank.
Believe it or not, this is our 200th main episode, and they said it would never last. Actually, the person who said it was me. For the special show, we've invited three of our favorite former guests, because they were the absolute best choices, and also they happen to be free tonight. Our first guest is an award-winning cartoonist, illustrator, and a friend and frequent guest on the podcast. His work has appeared in National Lampoon, Spy, The New Yorker, Time, and the recent humor publication, The American Bystander. His new book is Drew Freeman's Chosen People, which features portraits of everyone from Sammy Petrillo to George Zucco. And a new documentary about his life, The Vermeer of the Borscht Belt, is currently in the works. The artist formerly known as Judots, Drew Freedman. Our next guest is a musician, songwriter, record producer, playwright, novelist, and screenwriter. He's a Tony winner, a Drama Desk Award winner, the winner of the Edgar Award for Mystery Writing, and the recipient of ASCAP's
or ASCAP.
Yeah.
When the hell can we interrupt this? This is just dreadful. We've heard it all before.
In the middle of it.
Oh, my God.
In the middle of reading that, I said, something's not right here. This is a word. This isn't.
It's supposed to go a little faster.
It's ASCAP. And I think I...
Well, that made it go a little faster.
And I think I called you Freeman.
Freeman. You're thinking Mickey Freeman.
Yeah, yes, yes.
You want to tell the audience who this person is that you're talking about?
Okay, which one?
The one you're in the middle of introducing.
The ass guy.
Okay.
The ass something.
Okay. Okay. The recipient of ass... Recipient
ASCAP.
Of ASCAP's. Do you know, I think I once worked for ASCAP. to make it even worse. I once
like a temp job.
I had a crappy job.
Right.
I think it was ASCAP.
You blocked it. It was a bad memory. So
yeah,
you blocked
it. Horrible. Right. Now does what's his name? Former guest Paul Williams.
Yes,
he's the president. Yeah.
I am pretty sure it was a New York office.
He had nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
You want to introduce this man?
Where it says ASCAP, the Distinguished ASCAP Award, you can cancel the distinguished part now.
Yeah. George M. Cohen Award.
Yep.
He's worked with everyone from Jerry Lewis to Barbara Streisand to the Jackson 5, and he's the rare individual who can tell you the difference between the great Gildersleeve, Frank Nelson, and Gail Gordon, a creative
polymath,
and the ingenious Rupert Holmes.
Easy for you to say.
And last but never least.
Okay, hold on. The last time I was here, Frank wrote a long introduction and lost it.
That's true. I left it in my office.
I think we should do the same thing here.
Have you found it?
Well, in the interest of symmetry.
The last but never least, for his fourth appearance, a gifted and popular actor who's appeared on hit TV shows such as Mad About You, Spin City, Curb Your Enthusiasm, Gotham, and Red Oaks, and acclaimed films like Argo, Inside Out, and A Serious Man. He's also the winner of a Drama Desk Award and an Independent Spirit Award, and he's still pissed off at Mario Cantone for disrespecting Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol.
Absolutely wrong.
But he's never won anything from AFC. Our very own Tony Randall, the brilliantly funny Richard Kind.
Yes.
Now
there's no applause, and I said thank you.
Yes.
All right, there you go.
They can applaud. There's 62 people in the room.
Yeah, nobody applauds.
You're free to applaud.
We have a studio
those
audience
wonderful,
here.
Those wonderful this is ridiculous.
Now, I think all of us remember where we were when we found out Marlon Brando fucked Richard Pryor.
That's too soon.
It's the big opener he's been sitting on.
Wow. Started.
Talk about a big
opener. Who made the move?
Who made the move? He was sitting on.
Who had the courage?
What year was that? What year was that? I don't know that much about it, the details.
According to Quincy Jones.
Yeah. Who would know?
Marlon Brando fucked Richard Pryor in the ass.
Right. Well, he said he would fuck anything at that point. A mailbox.
True.
Well, that's a put down.
And who picked? Who fucked who?
Yeah, it was like who was on top and who was.
Well, I like to think Brando was on top.
Was this when they were making
the image of an 800-pound Brando?
Is this when he was making the Godfather?
Climbing on board of a terrified Richard Pryor.
I'm going to have to draw it.
And, yeah. And
yes, but if he was on top, you won't have to draw Richard Pryor.
Ah.
Okay.
And how would you find Marlon Brando's hand?
This is the what year Marlon Brando?
This is a warm-up. This is his warm-up.
He was
material.
Still in good shape in 1968.
Well, I like to think it was the Brando we all remember.
When it was in
like a ton.
The one from the Matthew Broderick film.
Are you incorporating a stick of butter into this image? That
yes. Excellent.
Good reference. So I think that lets us know who was on top.
No fingernails.
He's obsessed with this. Should we book Quincy Jones to settle this?
Quincy Jones as a co-host.
Okay. Right. Perfect timing.
Or Mrs. Pryor. Mrs. Pryor said that this is all true.
She said it's true.
A daughter.
His daughter denied it. His wife said it might be true.
His daughter denied it. But I mean, let's face it.
What was the opening line? Who hit on who?
Well, his daughter says it didn't happen.
Okay, so let's not ask her.
But no.
It's a good policy.
But, you know, let's face it. If you found out Marlon Brando fucked your father and he has, you deny it too. There's no way around it. Golly. You would have to deny it.
Can you imagine the farting that was going on during this too?
Yeah.
Because Brando was
Brando wanted to fart.
Brando was a notorious farter.
You heard one of Brando's farts.
It was not just a fart. It was a long, continuous fart.
Is it you who saw him outside the ice cream store?
Yes, yes. It's a story. Gilbert told an abbreviated version recently. But the longer version, which is not that long, but it was a Haagen-Dazs store in Sunset. Uh-huh. And this is the Sunset right around where Woody Allen was ordered ground yeast. So that's, you know, just picture that. I walked into a Haagen-Dazs store. And there's this big, big fat guy up at the counter.
Hey, give me a quart of quart of chocolate, quart of strawberry. Yeah.
Woman goes up to him and says, can I get your autograph? But
get the fuck away from me.
Wow.
So they give him the ice cream in one bag, and they give him an ice cream cone in the other with three giant scoops. He pays and walks out. He's wearing a big jumpsuit and aviator glasses. So he walks out with the cone in one hand, with the bag in the other, and I had to follow him. I just turned around and followed him 10 steps behind, walking up Sunset, and the cars are whizzing by, and the only sound I could hear was continuously. And I followed him for about a block, and that was enough. Wow. That's my Brando encounter.
So how long did this fart go on?
I'm sure it continued on because he wasn't stopping, but, you know, he was eating and farting. It was like, you know, my Brando memory.
Wow.
Well, one
last Brando story.
Go ahead.
I'm done.
On Facebook, a woman wrote in the inbox me, said, how come you only draw old, disgusting people? Why don't you draw the young and beautiful Marlon Brando, my favorite? I said, all right, look, let's compromise. I'll draw Marlon Brando for you. But I'll draw him when he was old, disgusting, and fat. How about that? She didn't answer.
Rupert, any Brando anecdotes?
I actually stood next to Marlon. Unfortunately, I don't have a great punchline for this. It's just a real story out of my life.
Okay, here's your punchline. And then he fucked Richard Pryor in the ass.
Okay.
Okay, right. So yeah, throw well, that I, in at the good. End.
I like it. It takes the suspense out of it and makes it more homespun. I was supposed to. I had for about 2 days, I was supposed to write the song that... Al, who's the singer? Al Martino. Al Martino sings us a wedding song. He's standing in for Frank Sinatra in Godfather. And I was supposed to write that song. And then someone who was related to an executive at Paramount said, no, don't you remember? I'm going to write that. And so as my consolation prize, I was invited to the set of The Godfather. And it was filmed at 127th Street Filmways. Do you remember when there was, for a while it became Foodways? This is a Marlon Brando story, but I'm realizing there's no humor involved.
Doesn't matter.
Okay. So I'm wandering up there to this, and they've replicated the entire Long Island mansion from Godfather inside this studio at like 127th and Adam Clayton Powell Boulevard. And I go in there, and I'm standing, and I'm watching this actor whose name is Al Pacino. And this Al Pacino has supposedly been chosen because he's the mob's choice. This is the stuff that was going around show business. That's the only reason they're using him. And then the big shame of Brando being in the movie was everyone knew it should be Edward G. Robinson, that he should play the Godfather. This, I'm not saying this as a fact. This was the scuttlebutt, was how can they not give it to Edward G. Robinson? And
Robinson was alive, huh?
Yeah, he was. So I'm standing there, and there's a scene with Al Pacino, this actor named Al Pacino. That's how they were pronouncing it. It's Pacino, of course, obviously. And it's the scene where the Godfather is telling Richard Castellano, and I forget the other one.
Abe Vigoda.
It was another one, too. That now Michael is going to be taking over the business and all like that. I'm standing next to this janitor who's obviously sweeping up. And he's in a ratty old gray sweater, and I'm thinking, how lovely that this old fellow, obviously a fixture of the place, is allowed to stay so close to the shooting. And I'm standing next to him for about 10 minutes while they do the scene. They have to go and tell Al Pacino, you're overlapping too much dialogue. We won't be able to cut. You're talking over too many people. You have to space it a little bit. It tightens up when we cut it. This is how he had done Panic in Needle Park, I think, just part of that. And suddenly they say, Mr. Brando now? And this janitor who's been standing next to me for 10 minutes moves forward. I never would have recognized him in a million years. No one had seen him with the cotton balls in his cheeks. And he was, looked, his hair was all unkempt and all like that. It was great. He did a good thing. Anytime he was doing a scene, a line, and he didn't like the way it was going, he would screw it up so that the scene would get screwed up and they'd have to start again. And he mainly played with a fish tank. And then, oddly enough, Richard Pryor arrived by cab.
Really? What happened? Yeah. Richard Pryor, what happened?
He said, hey, sweet cakes.
I knew it.
I haven't been getting enough of that Septuagenarian stuff. God. Yeah.
Heard right. this story.
Gilbert, did you know Danny Thomas wanted to play the Godfather?
Yeah,
it's true.
He did.
It's true.
He did.
Yeah.
Anthony Quinn. They seriously considered Anthony Quinn.
And of course,
Quinn's
Sinatra
right.
wanted to. Yeah.
But Paramount wouldn't go in for the Windex.
The clusters of the Windex
to clean the glass.
What a horrible
table.
Thing. I was at a golf tournament this weekend that raises a lot of money for St. Jude's. People got up with the most beautiful story about children and the families and the blessings that we are doing by giving money, and Danny Thomas finding it, and all I could think of the entire evening when they showed, oh, Danny Thomas, and he says, if I die and this place is built, I have lived for one thing, my reason on earth, and all I can think of. Was that?
It's like
it's glass, just all
girls
I can think
take the glass shitting on glass the glass.
Yes, now they're a great humanitarian, and that's how you've poisoned my mind.
It took 13 minutes to get to the Danny Thomas.
It's still controversy.
There's no reason to just malign Danny Thomas. For those sports fans out there, of which I know there are none, Jack Brickhouse, who used to announce for the White Sox,
right.
He used to like to get shit on.
Well, fantastic.
So if only ESPN would have me on a podcast, I could talk about something.
I wish I followed sports.
The other guy who was into it was Otto Preminger, of course.
Really?
Yeah, I've heard that.
He must have done everything.
Yeah, it was German, you know. It's like
Rupert, what pseudonym are you going to use for this episode?
I do have a Paul Scofield fart story.
Okay. Yes,
he was doing the misanthrope. I want to add a little clip.
Nice.
To tone it up.
He's doing the misanthrope in London with Diana Rigg, and he's walking across the front of the stage just going with each step, and the whole front row is going, oh my God, like that. They could hear and smell it all.
A fart for all seasons.
Very nice. Very nice.
Beautiful.
There are no small farts, only great actors. Yeah.
You never met Brando, Richard?
No. Oh, my God, no.
Yeah.
He was going to, Brando, there was a rumor he was going to do a version of The Odd Couple with Wally Cox.
He did other things.
Hollywood Reporter. They were roommates for years in the 50s.
Right. Yeah.
But the odd couple.
In the 50s.
And they say that Wally Cox was the masculine or the strong one.
That's what they say.
In the 50s, Wally Cox was called the original Richard Pryor.
Congratulations, Gilbert, on podcast number 200. This is Bill Macy from podcast number 172. We love you.
Oh, hi, fellows. It's Tom Leopold. I've had the privilege of being on your podcast. And apart from my children being born, it's the biggest honor and thrill of my life. I wanted to congratulate you on your 200th episode. And... I gotta go. That's my music. I love you.
And now while Gilbert heads into the Nutmeg Kitchen to steal more Perrier, a word from our sponsor.
And now back to the show.
Now you were telling us before you were at the home of, and I keep forgetting his name.
Emil Sitka.
Emil Sitka.
Emil Sitka, yeah. Well, yeah. In the 80s, I visited. I had friends who knew him. So Emil Sitka, of course, was the one, appeared in the Three Stooges shorts. He always played the professor and hold hands, you lovebirds. That guy, yes. with the white man. But he was as sweet as can be. And it was just like, I never met any of the actual Stooges, but I met Emil Sitka, corresponded with Joe Besser. You know, that's as close as I came. But Emil was terrific, and he was writing his autobiography. He was very passionate about it. But sadly, he died while he was writing it, so I never got to illustrate. He wanted me to illustrate it.
Yeah, I think that's great. You say that George Carlin gave you his number. Was it Richard Pryor?
Oh, yes, yes.
Call up. Have you ever called anybody up and just said, you know, like Dick Van Dyke called Stan Laurel.
He looked it up in the phone book.
Yes.
He looked it up in the phone
book. No, I understand that.
See, but
there are numbers I could probably get from somebody, but I would never.
I've had numbers of people like, I had George Carlin's number, Norman Fell's number, and Jonathan Winters. I didn't call any of them. I've had a few other numbers like that. And because to me, it was like kind of like when you get a girl's number and she goes, oh, hell, here's my number. Yeah, call me.
Right.
And here's my work number. Call me. Don't lose that. And then you call them. And
go, yeah, you know what? Please don't use this.
Yeah.
Yeah. You call them up. It's like, yeah.
You have the courage to go and visit somebody, right? To call them up?
Well, not really. I mean, I wait for the right opportunity. Like, you know, when I was a kid, I got to meet a lot of people through my dad.
Right.
So, you know, I kind of, you know, was taken along to Elaine's. And, you know, and I went to Groucho's house, you know, for the day.
When I was 14, with my brothers.
Yeah, we spent the day there. Then we were invited back the following week. Groucho's girlfriend, Erin Fleming, called my dad. Groucho would like you to come back next week. He loves kids. And they're having a reunion with Mae West, who hasn't seen in 35 years. So my dad said to my brothers and I, hey guys, we're invited back to Groucho's house. You want to go? And we looked at each other and said, nah, we had enough Groucho. You
know? Wow.
And that's like basically my only regret in life, that we didn't get to like witness that.
Well, I took my daughter. I was nominated for a Tony. Thank you very much. I was nominated for a Tony, so I go to the awards and I take my daughter. Okay, and my daughter meets Cicely Tyson and Bernadette Peters and David Hyde Pierce. She's sitting next to Zachary Quinto, who is a great guy and a great actor, but not in the pantheon of those names that he will be. But she's sitting next to her. She couldn't care less. She only wanted to meet Jane Lynch. All she wanted was the ice cream.
Because of Glee? Why Jane Lynch?
Because of Glee.
Glee, yeah.
Yeah. And I knew Jane way before. You know, I knew her before at Second City and stuff.
Is there anybody you've been dying to call, but you don't want to pick up the phone?
Yes, but I'm embarrassed to say it, and it's somebody who I shouldn't be embarrassed. There's a guy who wrote a book called Full Service. You know that book?
Oh, Scotty Bowers.
Yes.
You want to call Scotty Bowers?
Scotty Bowers.
Uh-huh.
I want to talk to him. I really do. I want to hear these shit stories about Charles Laughton. I want to hear them in person.
Did he write the Spencer Tracy book? Is that one?
Well, sort of.
Supposedly.
But he said, you know, there's no way that Catherine. By the way, my question always is, I mean, you just say about, you know, fucking the old Brando or whatever. I always say, if Catherine Hepburn, who was my favorite and I loved what she looked like, if she were alive today at 80, would I fuck her just to say, I fucked Catherine Hepburn? Okay. Has nothing to do with sex. It's, oh my God, look what I could tell my kids.
Yeah, well,
so.
Even Marie Saint looked pretty good last night on the Oscars, you know.
Yes.
Think about it. Would you, Gilbert, would you go there?
And Anthony Perkins' corpse. I would still fuck.
I'm gonna move this along now.
I knew him when he was still dating Grover Dale.
Anthony Perkins.
Yeah, he was great. The choreographer Grover Dale. Because he directed
who
my dad.
Was married to a beautiful actress, wasn't he?
I think he was.
He was married to Anita somebody. Was
Gillette, maybe? Or?
No, she was a nine.
Anita
won the Tony Award.
That's right. Someone told me.
Anita Morris, yeah.
Was that like a kind of a beard situation?
Hey, I'm not going to cast aspersions on anybody.
I always wondered about Herbert Ross and Lee Raswell.
Someone said to me they were at Curly Joe Dorita's house, and Emil Zitko was there.
Yeah, name makes sense. Makes sense.
And they said that Curly Joe Dorita agreed with Emil Zitka that Jules White was a schmuck.
Wow. And you know, of course, Frank went to Curly Joe Dorita's funeral.
I was there.
Yes.
Sad though it was.
There were about how many other people were there?
About eight.
And Curly Joe's gardeners were there, right?
Remember Curly Joe Dorita, the final stooge?
Yeah. Yeah. Who else was there? I know Moe's son was there.
Mark Newgarden dragged me there.
Moe's son was there.
Yeah, there were four gardeners in the back row.
Didn't Mark Newgarden encourage you to jump into the casket with Curly Joe?
No, but he was trying to snap pictures of the casket, of the open casket.
But there were gardeners in
a little tacky.
Some of Curly Joe's gardeners.
They did on the Steve Allen show. They did the Maha, Aha.
Yeah.
That was Dorita. That was
right, and you watch that and you just wish it was Curly there.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Instead of Joe Dorita fucking it up.
Now, you met Groucho.
Well, I met him in the context. Yeah, I met him, but it wasn't a Groucho that knew he was. It was in the last years of
He didn't know life. He was in the room.
I told you, I was at a Columbia Pictures 30th anniversary party. I was escorting Barbara Streisand, who I was recording an album with at that time. And at the table was Frank Capra, John Huston, Charles Bronson.
How about that, Rich?
Yeah.
Nice table.
And Groucho Marx. And I thought, if there's a photograph of this picture, and the caption says, "Circle who does not belong in this picture."
Why did you choose not to meet a couple of heroes?
I chose not to meet John Lennon, and I chose not to meet Cary Grant. There's no way they could have... I met Paul McCartney, and he was wonderful to me.
I bet Lennon would have lived up to your...
It's not even that. I just was so afraid he'd do something that would just say something. Or
Joni Mitchell tells about meeting John Lennon. He was nasty to her. And,
I've heard that backstory.
We had someone on the show who said some guy met John.
Well, it was a guitarist one of the guys that worked with the Turtles. It was Howard Taylor.
And he said John Lennon
was unkind.
Was so mean to him that he quit. Quit doing music.
He could just catch somebody at the wrong moment. Young George Carlin encountered Danny Kaye, his hero, and Danny Kaye was nasty to him.
Oh, yeah.
And it broke his heart.
Yeah.
And he would talk about it for years and years.
A wonderful writer named Rick Mitz who wrote a book called You know him?
Yeah, I know Rick.
They wrote a wonderful book called the great TV sitcom book or something like that. And he finally is writing. He worked for Norman Lear quite a bit. And he finally is writing a special for Mary Tyler Moore, who's only half the book that he's written. He so idolizes her. And I love Mary Tyler Moore. But they were shooting and he was the script writer. And they said, Mary, we want to introduce you to maybe your biggest fan in the history of the world. This is Rick Mitz. And she turned and said, "Yeah, look, this joke right here is absolutely no good. It's got to go. It just doesn't work for me." And that was it. In other words,
that was
his exchange was saying, "Look, nothing about very nice of you, and Liz, I have a little problem, but more just no, this has got to go," and destroyed his whole feeling about the series forever.
And sometimes you meet a hero of yours, and it's not even them; you're awkward among them, and you go, "Oh, God,
no,
why
I understand that, but I and you just don't have the words. You go back and you say, and if you're lucky, you get to meet them again and say, this is what I wanted to say to you last
time. Yes,
but the thing is that nowadays it's really hard. I know this because if I'm in a bad mood, if I've had an argument, if something's wrong, I've lost a job, whatever the hell it is, and somebody stops and goes, "You're great," and you just don't have the time. Something's wrong.
Yeah.
And it's not a good meeting. Facebook will have it. And I've met. Thank God. The only times I've been on Facebook where it has been something nice. I was in Connecticut and I'm shooting a movie, and there was a woman at the Audubon, the little zoo there, and she was holding a bird, and I was nice to her. And her mother Facebooked, "Richard Kind met my daughter and was so nice, he lives up to his name." Well, thank God I was nice then.
Yes.
But I'm not that nice.
Yeah.
I wish I were. I swear to God I wish I were.
I was performing at the Not the Diplomat. What is the beautiful hotel in San Francisco that was the actual lobby of the TV series hotel? The Fairmont. Fairmont in San Francisco, and it's the last remnant of a nightclub. And I'm singing a song, and suddenly a blonde who's 6'53", you know, the tallest person I've ever seen, with five sets of teeth, walks up on stage and starts singing the duet with me. And I'm looking, and I'm saying, I have no idea who this is and if this is a maniac. And I go along with it. We get to the end of the song, and in the last bar, I say, oh, that's Susan Anton.
Who's just come on? Sure.
Now, I'm not telling you this is the moment I've been waiting for all my life to meet Susan Anton. She happens to sing my song tonight, but her date is Dudley Moore.
Dudley Moore.
Dudley Moore, and we go and sit down, and I do that thing that you're talking about, Richard, which is I'm so desperate to let him know that I'm not just a fan of his, but that I know absolutely every single thing he's ever done, every movie, every short subject, what he played in Beyond the Fringe, and I poured this stuff out. Out of emotion, and when I was done, I thought, "What have I done? I just said no. You don't. I was doing that thing where they say no. I know a lot of people tell you they like you, but I really know. I remember 1960, and when you did Cynthia is a Dangerous Age, 30 is a Dangerous. And luckily, the next day, he called me, and I said, I'm so sorry about everything I said. We got to actually know each other, but it is that moment where if you don't handle that moment, you could blow it forever.
Absolutely, and you relive it, and it's just
gone.
And it also means nothing. When you go up to somebody and tell them, "I love you, I love you, I love you," you're doing it for you.
Mm.
You're not necessarily doing it for the person, unless it's told right. I shouldn't say what I just said.
You meet,
and Richard, I love everything you do.
Don't fuck yourself.
When you meet these celebrities.
No, I really mean it. A lot of people don't mean that. But when I say it, I really mean it. When I say God bless you, that's...
It's kind of like a stripper saying to you, oh, these other guys who are in here, oh, they're just such losers. But boy, you're different. You're a cool guy.
Your $100 bills are so much crisper than the other guys.
You know how to flip them.
Gil, you still carry those around with you, like the Jeff Bridges backstage. Was it the Tonight Show? Yeah, because I expressed some interest in booking Jeff Bridges for this show, and he said, can't do it.
Oh, so does he remember?
Traumatic experience. No, Gilbert can't do it. Jeff Bridges is forgotten.
You should have Jeff Bridges and Harry Shearer on one show.
Right.
Bridges was one of those people I met. I had a photo when I was a kid, I took a photo of Lloyd Bridges in Central Park, and I wanted to show it to him. And there was nothing wrong with Jeff Bridges that I could figure out in the story, just me. And I wrote him. I have like an enemy list of who I say people who are enemies of mine. And I put Jeff Bridges and Harrison Ford. Because also, I met Harrison Ford. He complimented me.
I remember you told this story.
The aristocrats. But I was like a schmuck. And I said like, thank you. And I figured, rather than say, hey, I'm a big fan, thanks for saying that, I said, oh, thank you, and your name is? And I thought, that didn't work.
It didn't work.
Yeah,
but you know what? That's his fault, because I have a similar story. This was hilarious to me, and it went over. I'll tell you. I'm at the Washington Press Corps dinner, and I'm standing with Marty Short, who I know pretty well from Second City and everything. I did a movie with him. And Steven Spielberg is there, who's very good friends with Marty. And we're talking. And Spielberg pulls out his phone and goes, I got to get a picture of this. And I go, no pictures. I said that to Spielberg.
Oh, God.
It's hilarious. That's hilarious.
It is. Very funny.
And
you're correct.
And Spielberg go, oh, I'm sorry, and put the phone on. I go, I'm so kidding, Steve. I'm kidding. But I did have one very funny thing. Because, I mean, when you're in that position and you pray to God, you have something witty, which I think the thing to Harrison Ford is, shame on Harrison Ford for not getting it. Michael Mann, who used to drive race cars, was directing a show I did called Luck, and he was producing it, and he's in a golf cart with Dustin Hoffman and his wife, okay? And he's driving really fast, and he comes toward me really, really fast and then puts on the brake. And what do you think I had the wherewithal to say at that time?
You said, "I'm walking over here."
That's right. I said, "I'm walking here." I'm and I
perfect.
Said,
just
"God bless me. Who would have thought that I'd be so good?" That, you know, I mean, I'll disparage myself, but when I'm good, that was fantastic. But I can't believe.
What was the reaction?
Yeah.
No. I did it for me. Like I said, he doesn't give a good goddamn fuck about who I am.
I'd been working with Barbara Streisand for about a week. And she suddenly, and I'm there as both a songwriter and as the arranger of the album we're doing and the producer, and I'm kind of full of myself at that point. I'm thinking, I'm doing all right here. Okay. She starts to praise another songwriter. And she says, you know, I saw that Mac Davis, he has a summer replacement show, and he has a segment where he just makes up a song on the spot. Just someone throws a sentence at him. He must be really, really brilliant to be able to do that. I so admire that. I said, I know what you mean, Barbara. I said, it's kind of like the thrill you get when Liza Minnelli hits a high note. And she looked at me like, why would you do that? Why would you ever? It took me about another week to just get back to sea
was
level.
Was it a
again.
Joke or did you?
No, I meant it as a joke. I was doing
oh,
what
of
you,
course.
You know, I was doing that thing.
That's yes, but I'd want to dig my head in the sand. if she did not get that joke. Oh
no, she did. Oh. It was just like I don't do those kind of jokes. You understand?
Oh,
like
my,
I don't do.
Oh my.
We don't do the self-deprecating.
She used to read Mad Magazine when she was younger.
Did
I
she?
Know that. Yeah, she was a Mad fan. What happened? But Richard asked earlier if I ever called celebrities. I never did, but I waited to the point where celebrities would occasionally call me because they knew my work or I draw them. And the special one was Jerry Lewis, who I know Richard knows. I mean, Rupert, you know him. Have you met Jerry Lewis?
I did meet him, yeah.
But he called me out of the blue, although I was prepared ahead of time. Jerry Lewis is going to call you because I did a tribute to him. So, you know, I was really nervous because he's a hero of mine. And I love everything about Jerry Lewis, even the Vegas, schlocky the side of him, his movies, even the shitty ones. I just love it all. You have to love it all to love Jerry Lewis. So that was like, you know, I was so nervous. And Kathy knows, like, you know, I was like, you know, just like waiting for the call. And he couldn't have been lovelier, you know, but
he had seen your picture.
I had done a tribute to him about how the Academy should give him a special Academy Award.
Oh, so written.
So it was in the New York Observer. He saw it. They sent it to him. So he called out of the blue and said, Drew, thank you for that. I loved it. But he had to test me. He said, Drew, do you know what I invented? You know, I said, oh, shit. What did Jerry Lewis? Video assist. It came to me.
He said, that's it. That's all I care about being remembered for. Video assist.
Wow. You know, what's the video assist is, you know, that he worked out on the bellboy. So after that, you know, we became friendly. He would call me, Drew, what are you working on? And I would like, you know, to tell him like, oh, well, I'm doing a drawing of, of the Friends or, you know, whatever it was. You know, it just became a regular thing where it's like, so I was like waiting for like people to call me. You know, I was waiting for that point. And that actually happened.
You all had a good experience of, because I know Rupert did. Rupert worked with him for a while. He's always been great
now,
to Gil.
Yeah. Now with me, with Jerry Lewis, and it was just, you know, not that much. But I remember I can use that classic line, which is, well, he was always nice to me.
The Kathleen Freeman line.
Yes, yes. I met her and, I met Kathleen Freeman. And I talked to her and she said how he used to hire people, you know, a stock company, people he liked. And then I said, I heard. Someone told me he was the most hated man in showbiz, and she gives this pained look on her face and just kind of a little nod. She goes,
but he liked you.
Yeah.
He was good to you, and he was good to Rupert.
He was wonderful.
But you had a great working relationship with him and good stuff. I'll tell you a funny story that brings back somebody that we worked with on Mad About You. Danny Jacobson, who created the show, wrote an episode where they're going to do a documentary on a very famous person. And he kept telling me, we're getting Marlon Brando. We're going to get Marlon Brando. And they had Paul Reiser call Brando. Brando goes, what the fuck is this? But they got Jerry Lewis. He did the episode.
Were you in the episode with Mel Brooks?
No, I wasn't with Mel Brooks. I wasn't with Carol Burnett.
I'm sorry to bring it up.
And I wasn't in the one with Jerry Lewis. And they all said that the thing was going to be, is that Paul is doing a documentary and Jerry Lewis takes a liking to me and not to Paul. And I was not in the episode. They didn't write me in. So that's...
And Jerry Lewis, one of those things that was like an honor. I was at some event and Jerry Lewis was there and I went on and just went nutty on stage. And Jerry Lewis came up to me afterwards and in that serious Jerry. And he said, "Gilbert, you are out of your fucking mind." And then there's a pause and he goes, "And I wouldn't want you any other way." And I thought, wow, that's...
I was witness to you doing the Aristocrats joke with Jerry, like having his stroke that night or heart attack.
Yes.
What do you mean?
At the Hilton, they had a giant roast.
Yeah.
Frank, you were there, right?
Yeah, I was there.
Yeah.
I was there, and Gilbert, you know, and Jerry, you know, he like looked purple, like almost, or, you know, pale purple.
But you
launched into it, and he was pounding the desk, sort of like, you know, the Dean Martin roast where people were doing the fake pounding. He was doing that, too, but he said he doesn't remember anything about that roast.
Yeah.
I talked to him about it because I was going to go up to him. I hadn't met him yet, but I was going to approach him, and I said, I can't approach him this way. He looks terrible. He's sitting there, you know, between De Niro and De Niro and Scorsese, but he looked so awful. I backed off.
He did. Someone... I wanted to have a picture of him laughing while I was at the podium. And they sent me a bunch of photos from the Friars, and I didn't want any of them.
Ava Goda looked better than him that night.
Yeah. Like, yeah. He was scary.
My friend Grant Heslov, who produced Argo, was friends with Jerry Lewis's son. And he has a sleepover one night when he's a kid. And he has to get up and goes to the bathroom. And he goes out into the hall, and there's Jerry Lewis on his back with such terrible back pain. And he's writhing, and he just goes, "Just go, just go, just go. Like, walk ahead. Don't worry. I'm all right. Just go." So that guy must have been in a lot of pain, and a reason that those pills made him bloat and all of that stuff. So
Rupe, there's a case of you meeting a hero, and did you have trepidation the way you did with Cary Grant, or did you just you didn't have a choice because you were working?
No,
the
most
project.
Terrifying part of it with meeting Jerry, I think if Jerry knows that you love him, and that was I didn't have to fake that because I did, I think you're in good shape. But I had written a novel.
Trump.
I had written a novel, as Gilbert is always pointing out. My first novel was about a comedy team. It was called Where the Truth Lies. They made a movie of it with Colin Firth and Kevin Bacon. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of, you know, one of those Romana Clay where the characters parallel Martin and Lewis. And there is a payoff within the mystery novel that implies that maybe these characters who were patterned after Martin and Lewis, one night, one of them had tried to be Richard Pryor and Marlon Brando. And it's part of the... Now, the Jerry Lewis character is not the... is the one who rejects that. And it was based on the idea that Martin and Lewis split up and we could never accept that. When I was a kid, that was like... destroyed our lives. We just did... Because we believed in their friendship and their love and all like that. And suddenly they weren't talking to each other. And no one ever explained why. So it was patterned after that. He knew about this book, and he knew that it was a great appreciation of him, and I was terrified for the entire time that I worked with him that he would read the book, and he asked me to send him a copy. Jerry Lewis, like, I'm going to send him a book, and it's 380
but if
pages.
But he knew about
he
the book.
He knew about the book, and he knew that it was very reverent to him, but I was terrified all the time that we're having this wonderful friendship and honeymoon together and creating together, that one day he would actually get to the end of it and say, I don't know that I like this.
Rupert, I share that terror, because during my friendship with Jerry, I was absolutely terrified that he would know that I was the guy who illustrated the Spy magazine article about the day the clown crossed.
He never hated that together, huh?
He hated that. No, he never. And I was terrified. And when he finally died, I was relieved. Like, oh, I can finally relax. He's not going to know. You know, I was terrified about that. I told Kathy, I said, if somebody wants to, like, you know, do something negative about to me, they could send that to Jerry and say, hey, your friend Drew Friedman, he illustrated you, you know, with that horrible article about that movie. And it never came up. Yeah.
I remember when at the roast, after I got off, I thought, oh, you know, I used to do a bit in my act where I'd imitate Jerry Lewis singing When You Walk Through a Storm. And I thought, oh, why didn't I do that? I should have done that. That would have been perfect. And I was kicking myself. And then I saw some clip that they have on the internet of someone doing that. And he goes, you know, they were getting people from the audience to do shtick. And one guy said, I can do you singing when... And he started to do that, and Lewis was,
That's not funny. Not funny.
Right.
He really hated the Petrillo thing, huh? He really just...
Oh, yeah.
Well, he you know, he hired Sammy Petrillo. I'm not going to explain who Sammy Petrillo is
to
this
audience. Listen to this show...
She hired the 16-year-old Sammy Petrillo to use on the Colbert Comedy.
Clone,
yes,
of Jerry.
He did the
Lewis.
Best imitation ever.
You know,
of Jerry
no,
Lewis.
I certainly know who
Scary.
He is, and yet I've never seen him.
Well, he's in one movie, Bela Lugosi Meets a Brooklyn Gorilla.
I remember
which is,
that.
You know, a ridiculous title, but he's 17 in that, and they teamed him up with a guy who kind of looks like Dean Martin,
Duke Mitchell.
Yeah. And he's
he
like,
looks like Dean Martin the way I look.
And Bela Lugosi,
like
but Bela Lugosi actually
sings like Dean Martin, like I sing.
Bela Lugosi
like
actually
Martin.
Thought he was working with Jerry Lewis. They said he would call him. He would call him Jerry.
Wasn't there a movie with Anne Bancroft where she's with a gorilla or something?
Yes.
Raymond
yes.
Burr. I think Raymond Burr's
yes,
in that.
Yes, Raymond Burr's in that. It's got a French setting. Gorilla right. Large. Gorilla
that's right.
Large.
Oh, okay,
gorilla
thank you.
Bless
large.
Your heart,
that's
Rupert.
Right.
Because you mentioned that when I'm going, that can't be what Anne Bancroft was in.
She wears like a sarong,
look,
I think.
Jessica Lange was right. Her
she
first
with
film.
Gorilla.
Was
right.
That was that terrible, the bad the Dino De Laurentiis King
oh,
Kong.
Oh, with one is
Rich
called
Jeff
King
Bridges.
Kong. The other and it has a multi-million dollar budget. The other is Raymond Burr with Anne Bancroft and a gorilla. There is no equivalent, Rupert. That
have you ever seen City Across the River and Tony Curtis is in the movie and he has no lines?
And well, he's just a presence. He's
you
a
can
presence.
See him trying. If when you look at him, because you know it's going to be Tony Curtis growing up, and he's in the movie and he's like trying to make something out of his...
Peter Fernandez is the star, and you would only remember him because he was the voice of Speed Racer. You know, he went nowhere. The young Richard Jekyll was in that. Not a bad film.
Raymond Burr.
Why don't you get him?
Wow. Gorilla at Large.
Are you sure he's around?
Yeah, he's I looked him up.
I think Gorilla at Large was a
3D movie. 53.
Gorilla at Large was a 3D movie. That made it a little notch better.
Raymond Burr was Bride of the Gorilla.
Was that the one?
Yeah, no, with Lon Cheney Jr.
A couple of gorillas.
He's not.
Where are you?
No, Raymond
he's
Burr
in,
was.
Yeah.
I'm not authoritative on that. I do know. The one I know is there's one with Merv Griffin. What is that?
Really? Oh, yeah.
Is that Murders in the Rue Morgue?
Mad Magician, possibly?
Well, Mad Magician's Vincent
Price.
That was a 3D.
That's a Corman,
that's right.
Isn't it?
That was a 3D.
No, that was pre-Corman.
Was it?
Well, it might have. He might have worked. It was
I know Mad Magician. Yes,
Mad Price. Magician.
It was a slew of gorilla films in the early 50s for some. With people clamoring to see gorilla movies.
There was one good gorilla suit in Hollywood.
It's like, why?
Just like 20th, there was one good bra. Yeah. For 20th Century Fox, and every woman wore it, and when they wore it, they were maybe
Ben
Bob
Doran. Burns, who's been on this show, bought a gorilla suit so he could get work.
Well, he had a thriving career. Right. There were a couple of guys like that.
Johas Prohaska.
Well, who was the guy? Who did?
There was a guy who was a stuntman who dressed as a gorilla.
And there's that story.
He was a great gorilla.
Oh, I almost forgot. Do you have any questions for Groucho Marx?
Yeah, of course. Groucho, why did you pay that porn star hush money?
Because Chico needed the money.
Groucho, why did you call Africa and Haiti shithole countries?
Because Chico needed the money.
Thank you.
That's the Groucho that Rupert met.
That's the Groucho I met. Yeah,
that's the one I met too, sadly.
I met a lively Aaron Fleming. Aaron?
He was always lively.
Aaron. You met her in Fleming, too?
Yeah, I didn't see her beating, throwing Groucho down the stairs or anything. She kept all that hidden, beating him up.
What was
beating
Aaron
him up,
like when you met her?
Ooh.
Aaron Fleming.
Oh, I mean, I'm talking about one evening.
Oh, yeah.
She seemed to try. I don't know why, but feel sympathetic toward her a little bit.
Yeah, sad.
I feel
like ultimately, but you know, she's a villain.
The lovely line that he said was, "Who laughs at all my jokes?"
Well, there's always footage of him looking at her lovingly, like at the Oscars when they gave him the special Oscar. He only thanks her. He thanks Harpo, Chico, my brothers, and Aaron Fleming, you know. But he just looks. There's so much footage of him just looking at her so lovingly.
It's just
faking
a woman.
That.
I don't think you.
It's
I think
just amazing.
And I watched them together, like really closely. I was like fixated on him mainly. I was watching him eat his lunch, dripping like his cream corn down his chin
cheese
and stuff. But I was just like, during my day with Groucho, it was 1975, so I was 16. And I was just watching him, and at one point I was thinking, I'm probably the luckiest kid in the world at this moment.
You knew it.
I knew it. I appreciated the moment. And I said, I'm just going to stare at him and engage him a little bit, but just let him go about it. I just watched him. We put him to bed that night. We put him in his pajamas.
Right.
He watched an episode of You Bet Your Life because it came back in syndication for half an hour in Hollywood and New York.
And he watched.
He would rewatch them, and you know, it would make him happy. And then he would go to bed, and my dad gave him one of his novels. And Groucho took that to bed with him. And he was just, you know, it was a sweet, really sweet moment, you know. And he had this beautiful bed that was constructed from, like some of his old vaudeville sets. And, you know, so we put him to bed, you know, and then we left. And during the day, Elliot Gould was there and Sally Kellerman and Dennis Wilson. This, like, all these young Hollywood people would
come,
would,
to pay their
come in.
Dennis Wilson?
Yeah, from the beach.
Oh,
right.
George,
wife Karen Lamb.
George Siegel there too?
No, he wasn't there that day. Elliot Gould was there. Huh? Sally Kellerman.
George Siegel was at the thing that I was at your with thing. Groucho. Same year. 75,
yeah. Bud Cort was not there. That it was like these regular people would come in. I think they were coming in to do other things in the bathroom, but you know, I wasn't.
Alice Cooper had lunch with them on a number of occasions.
We've been trying to get Alice Cooper.
Well, Aaron Fleming brought in all these. You know, Groucho liked to be surrounded by these younger. You know, famous people and kids and stuff. So,
but meeting all these legends, that's what I wanted to do. I don't care about meeting some of the people that are around today. Like, you know, I mean, I want to meet these legends. I really, really do.
Like Gilbert.
The legends are, you know.
Like, and I waited until he was old.
And I
when
remember.
When you see me, cream corn.
I just got a flashback when I met Jeff Bridges. I wanted to tell him that story that I used to go to Central Park with my sisters, and there was Lloyd Bridges. And I started to say, you know, when I was a kid, my sisters and I would travel from Brooklyn to Manhattan. And one time we were in, and he goes, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And it's like, come on, move the story ahead. And it was like, oh, no.
That's it. That's
yeah,
that's
yeah. So that's all
thing.
I could think of.
But you want to know something that this is true, too, is that you got to remember, even when you hate it, those people coming up. Like, I remember I went to see Godspell on a Sunday afternoon with my parents. And at intermission, you go up on stage, and they give you fake wine or something like that. It's whatever, they're all singing, and then it's intermission. And I look out in the theater, and there was Hal Prince with his wife and his two kids. All right, I've been directed 3 times by Hal Prince now. Daisy is married to one of my best friends from Spin City. Daisy's a dear friend, and all I remember is going to my mom and dad, it's Hal Prince. That's Hal Prince. And what kind of a idiot kid at age 12 or 13 knows what Hal Prince looks like.
You do.
And I did. And I couldn't believe. Oh my God, it's Hal Prince. And then, you know, who would think? You don't think of these things.
I love that you knew who Hal Prince was at 12.
I was walking Kathy to work on Lafayette Street like 25 years ago, and there was a tall guy walking his puppy. And I realized it was Fred Gwynne, who's like, you know, I adore Fred Gwynne from Car 54, especially, and the Munsters. And Kathy said, go introduce yourself. And I just couldn't let myself do it. You know, he was walking his puppy. He was concentrating on that. I just loved him so much. It's like, you know, it's like I didn't want to bother him and even to tell him how much I loved him.
But there is the story. Are you doing that for you?
Right.
Or are you doing that for him?
I passed. I can't do it. Yeah. I adore the man. And I just don't want to meet him this way.
But this is a good
And then
time.
He died soon after.
Fred Gwynne.
Yeah. This would be
a
good time for
all of us. Do you have any questions for us, Frank?
I want to shame Gilbert for not calling Mel Brooks. I think this would be a good segue.
You're an idiot.
Yeah.
You're an idiot for not calling Mel Brooks. You're an utter idiot.
I kind of think if you went up to Fred Gwynne and said you liked the Munsters, he was embarrassed.
He was.
About the Munsters for years.
I would have brought up Car 54, which
yeah,
you know,
of course.
I
adore. Oh, you bring up Cotton Club or he did Big Daddy on Broadway.
Wonderful film called Vanishing Act with Mike Farrell and Elliot Gould and Margot Kidder that is one of the great surprise twists in it.
I don't know that movie.
Yeah, it's very obscure. Cool. You can't find it on DVD. Written by Levinson and Link.
He was in a production.
And in Pet Sematary.
He was in a production of Arsenic and Olace with Bob Crane.
That's right.
Yes, he was. A really interesting cast.
Helen Hayes?
Sue Lyon, Bob Crane.
Helen Hayes,
right, and Lillian Gish.
And Lillian Gish, right.
It's like it's on YouTube, but Fred Gwynne played the brother.
Now, see, I remember Jonathan, those old things. That was that, and I believe Armstrong, the Armstrong tile and everything. I think they were the spot. Wow. These are the things. I remember those things. Who sponsored it?
'69 before now, Bob Crane.
I remember, and now I'm getting a total mental block of someone we talk about on every episode of the show, practice.
Cesar Romero.
Perfecto Toles?
No. Cracker Jacks.
Oh, Jack Gilford.
Yeah. Wasn't he Dr. Einstein?
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
Yes, he was.
Wow.
Very good.
See, the one that I remember, this is so weird. Robert Goulet and Peter Falk did a production of Brigadoon. And it was started at 9 o'clock. And my parents wouldn't let me watch it because it was Sunday night.
Wow.
And I sat outside their bedroom door and sobbed like, I'll show you. And they wouldn't let me watch it because it was on too late. And I cried and I cried. That's the kind of kid I was.
Oh, jeez.
I had parents who understood. They were wonderful. One night at 11:15 or 11:30, they woke me. Because you have to understand that in the 50s and into the 60s, until Saturday night at the movies, you didn't see recent films on TV.
No.
It was all British films and they woke me because somehow at 11:30 at night, there was a Martin and Lewis movie on television on the Late Show. And they actually got me out of bed and said, you can stay up. Because there was no hope of ever seeing a Martin and Lewis movie when you were like 11 in that year. Wow. Well, I'm watching, we're staring. And I say, I don't think it's Martin and Lewis. And it was Sammy Petrillo and Duke Mitchell.
Wow.
In
Brooklyn.
That's how I felt when I first, I didn't know what I was watching. Yeah. I was about 10 maybe.
He's pretty good.
I wasn't prepared for it.
He came pretty close.
Yeah. It was surreal.
He had that haircut.
Yeah.
It was like really Jim Carrey and Dumb and Dumber.
Really channeled Jerry Lewis.
But Duke Mitchell was a...
Yeah, him you knew it was
fake. He had the right initials.
I defend that film as possibly being as good or if not better than some Martin and Lewis films, which were really not very good.
It wasn't terrible. The budget really showed.
Plus,
the
it had Bela Lugosi, and none of the Martin Lewis films had a villain
had a really
that
good
intense
villain. Yeah.
And legendary.
Yeah.
You remember who directed it?
William Bodine.
One shot Bodine.
Yes.
And it's funny when you watch the Martin and Lewis films, it's like, with the exception of a scene here or there, I mean, they're pretty bad.
Unless, you know, the last ones, you know, when they got Frank Tashlin finally.
Yes.
Do those, like, full-color CinemaScope films. Those were special. You know?
Yeah.
Even though Martin and Lewis weren't even speaking with each other when they made Hollywood or Bust.
I thought You're Never Too Young was good.
That's Major in the Minor,
isn't it? They were remade. Yeah,
they do a wonderful... Streets of Boulevard in old New York.
They introduced a lot of
shows. Also the one of the Carol Lombard... Frederick March movie.
Nothing Sacred became what?
What is it? Which one
Living
is
It Up.
Living It Up. Okay,
with
that's
Sherry
not
North,
bad.
He does the dance with Sherry
that's not
North.
Bad.
That was
Living
hysterical.
It Up has Bobby Barber in it.
Jerry Lewis doing the jitterbug with Sherry North.
Oh, it's hilarious. You can go on YouTube and watch it.
Hysterical.
I asked him about that. I said, how much of that, I knew what the answer would be. I said, how much of that was choreographed? He said, absolutely none of it. Absolutely none of it. He said, I'm just doing. I asked him one time, I said, where did you learn to do? You know, you nice dancer. When they do their little moves, maybe you don't agree, but.
No. I'm thinking, no, it's obvious where he did it. He was raised. Yeah,
absolutely. And so when they would go into any kind of hoofing, Martin would do a completely serviceable job if they were doing a number, but Jerry was like, good.
Jerry also he spazzed out. He had no control.
What's the wonderful North dancing that they do with
winging.
It's not the Nicholas Brothers because there's three of them.
Hysterical.
It's fabulous.
Yeah.
And
amazing.
Also the number he does, is this in the Major and the Minor remake? With the girls' school. And he's just, they've got to imitate everything that he's doing. Yes. They're like marching in platoons or something like that.
But the two, I'm shocked that Dean Martin could dance the way he did.
That's what I'm saying.
Because I don't believe in a barbershop, you know, he was dancing. I believe Jerry Lewis was dancing as a kid.
I think people just pick. They just, if you're going to be in show business, you had to learn stuff. My father used to always point out to me that there'd be, like, you'd see a Jack Benny special or any stuff, and there'd be a guest on the show, and they'd do some, they'd just know, if they did something impromptu, they'd know some time steps. They knew they just knew it because you were supposed to know.
Look at Bob Hope dancing with Jimmy Cagney.
Years ago, everybody in show business did everything.
Yeah.
Right. That's right. You had to.
Everyone was able to sing. They might not
had
be
that great
Sinatra.
Segment of like showing like James Stewart singing and Robert Montgomery singing and Clark Gable singing.
Clark Gable and nothing.
Joan Crawford.
And you had to learn to ride a horse too if you're going to be in the movies because maybe someday you would.
And
have
it's
to.
Like every comedian in the middle of his jokes would sing, do a little dance.
Now, Clark Gable and Andy Devine.
You're going back there, huh?
Let's get back to the meat of Hollywood.
Supposedly the original Brokeback Mountain.
Yes.
So we've heard and speculated he would leave Carol Lombard for Andy Devine on those weekends.
All right. As long as you're working blue.
And Andy Devine
with Lucille. It was a musical. Lucille.
And say.
You'll hear it on the broadcast.
What's the question, Rupert?
Keep going if you don't stop him.
There's some musical with Victor Mature and Lucille Ball, and Victor Mature should not be in a musical.
Well, his daughter's on Facebook, by the way, Victoria Mature. She loves this show.
I don't know.
She writes about this show.
Keep telling me, you know, Shemp's nieces are
no,
on
it's
Facebook?
His daughter. Because Gilbert loves After the Fox.
Okay.
So she chimed in on Facebook.
With the original Victor Mature. That was the billing.
Yeah.
Really? Yeah. Tony Powell.
In the actual
Tony Powell.
Remember the ad because Frank Frazetta painted the ad for that After the Fox.
Mm. You want to tell your
who is the fox?
All right, I know it was coming.
Who are you? I am me. Who is me? I am a thief. You caused your mother lots of grief. So after the fox.
Sang this with Robert Wolf.
Yeah. Burt Bacharach.
Burt Bacharach and Devin.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
They were writing all to it. Little Red Book from Casino Royale, I think, was. And the Look of Love.
The opening.
He wrote the Blob theme song.
The only thing worthwhile with Casino Royale, because it's a terrible movie, a mess, but that opening with Burt Bacharach's theme.
Yeah.
The light shining and Burt Bacharach. I mean, that I think is great.
The film has a couple of moments, I think.
Woody Allen has a few moments. Woody is excellent in it.
Yeah. And maybe that's about it. But Peter Sellers, you know, I loved it so much when I was a kid. I haven't seen it in maybe 40 years. So I guess it doesn't hold up. So
what other movies when you were a kid? I'm going to do Frank's job.
Go ahead,
you
Rich.
Loved when you were a kid and you saw it again.
Someone should do Frank's job.
Well, we were talking earlier about the first nude women we saw on film. When did we first see nude women in entertainment? Mine was on stage.
Gilbert, do you have a memory? I was forced because my father's plays had nudity, so I was like...
Your father deserves some credit for bringing nudity to broadcast television.
Your dad...
Well, people still thank me, talk to your dad, thank him for, like, introducing nudity to network television.
Here's Valerie Perrine nudity.
Yep, I said it was Scuba Duba, but it's not. It was Steam Bath.
The TV version in 73.
Here's a memory.
Produced by Norman Lloyd, who's still around.
Yeah, Norman Lloyd. Is that the same Norman Lloyd?
Yeah, the one who was in Hitchcock.
I was watching TV when I was a kid. And when I was a kid, You didn't see cleavage on TV. Forget it. They had a news story, and it was this girl riding a dolphin or a killer whale at SeaWorld, one of those places. And the thing went crazy. It started something, maybe a flashbulb went off, and it started leaping around, and they had to pull the girl out of the water or she'd be killed. And they, when they're lifting her out of the water, her bikini bottom was down on TV.
No.
And her ass was showing.
Change your life, Gil.
Did you have a bonus?
I ran to my bed.
And you prayed for this young woman.
Do you want to know something? I was so horny from this. I don't think I even touched it. Oh, and I just shot off.
How far did you shoot?
Across the room. It was like,
do you remember
I don't think my hand went near it.
It was actually footage of Mamie Eisenhower's nipple once. In the 50s. I've never seen it. I think
a man can dream.
I've heard about it my whole life.
No, Rupert has a story.
What?
You want to tell the Georgina Spelvin story as long as we're on the
cover? Oh, no. You want to know something? The level of blue, the shades of blue we've reached make my little racy story so tame by comparison.
Well, you end it with, and then you saw Marlon Brando fucking Richard Pryor in there.
As long as I do this, we've circled
ending. What? You want to talk about the Tom Jones Rondo Hatton thing that you wrote me about? Because Drew will be fascinated.
No.
What did they have to do?
It was a one liner. It was a one liner. No. You did this wonderful tribute to Rondo Hatton.
Thank you.
Which was very touching and very moving. You know who Rondo Hatton was? And his first film where he was prominently featured, I know because it was a Sherlock Holmes film. It was called Pearl of Death. We're getting quiet in here like I'm telling a great story. We're still on the same level of completely empty trivia that we've been on. Rondo Hatton, and
my silence thing. Was, who played Sherlock Holmes in Pearl of Death?
Basil Rathbone, Nigel Bruce.
Oh, it was, okay.
The disease
was
acromegaly, the same disease Paul Benedict had on the Jeffersons.
Yes, in fact, I heard Paul Benedict was doing a play.
You heard it from me.
Fuck you.
And now I can finally do it while I'm driving in my car or working out and I hear these things. I go, I told you the fucking story. It was me. And you're telling it wrong. No, it's interesting. And then let's go.
Yeah, that he was doing a play. And a guy said, hi, I'm a doctor. I want to talk to you afterwards. And he thought, oh, a doctor, he probably wants my autograph. And he said, I was looking at you on stage, and I think you have a disorder called acromegaly, and that's how he found out about it.
I may have written that play. Paul Benedict.
Did the choreography.
Did he tour with Accomplice?
I did. No. He did a play that I wrote based on the children's books Goosebumps by R.L. Stein, and he played the lead character for like 7 months touring the States. And I don't remember him ever sharing that at the time. What do you know what year this was? Oh, you knew this.
It might have been he was doing the Pacino thing, playing the bartender in Huey.
Right, okay.
I think is what it is.
So Rhonda Hatton was, and by the way, there was Evelyn Ankers, who's in a lot of your favorite Universal films.
She was one of the stock players in the old Monster Machine. She was in the Wolfman.
If she was just sort of the she was the... Olivia de Havilland of Monster.
She a mad-made monster, Gilbert?
That's later. I think that's 50.
What was Chaney's first horror film?
I've never even heard of that movie.
That Frozen one where Ghost? He lights up.
Is it The Frozen Ghost?
Well, with Indestructible Man?
That was No. That was way... That was the alcoholic.
He gets flame-torched in Indestructible Man. Right.
But this was
that's
the one...
That's Joe Flynn, I think, was
it
in.
It may have been man-made monster. Yes, Joe Flynn.
Absolutely.
And Robert Shane. The inspector from Superman.
Yes. But when you used to come to my apartment, we'd watch that one.
Yes.
Yogurt used to come to my apartment on 6th Street back in the 80s. And we'd sit in silence and watch horror movies. Because I had a VCR and Gilbert didn't. So, you know, I had a collection of
them. And he would just knock and come in.
He would just, unannounced, he'd come in.
Yeah, because my
I'd take his coat off. And
my mother lived about a block from you. And I'd visit her. And on the way back home, I'd stop at your house.
And I had an assignment, but I put it aside to, like, make Gilbert
and
come.
And we'd watch a Lon Chaney Jr. movie.
Well, Indestructible Man of the Manster, or The Haunted Strangler, or the Martin Mull George Maharis show.
I think The Indestructible Man is the first
the one with Carla horror movie.
You were scared out of your wits.
No, even that, even back then.
The close-ups of Chaney with the baggy
that
eyes. That was scary.
But the wrong reason.
He was already a condition he was in.
Full tilt alcoholic.
When we watched that at the Central Theater in Pearl River, we couldn't tell if that was supposed to be makeup. We thought, are they making that man look that way? And no, he was just...
Didn't need the makeup at that
He didn't
point.
Need the makeup. I mean, I'm not being snide about it. He was a wonderful actor.
Gilbert, Frank, Dara, and Big Frank, just for you, my brand new Helen Keller joke. Knock, knock. Congratulations on 200 episodes. That's fantastic.
Hi, this is Penn Jillette. There is no God.
Oh, hi, this is Billy West. Hi, Gilbert, Frank, and the other Frank, and Dara. Congratulations on 200 shows of the Gilbert Gottfried Amazing Colossal Podcast. I love you. I'm just showing you a little love. Oh, you want me to show it to you? This is the love of my life. Look at it. Look at it. What is it, too disgusting for you, too ugly? Look at it.
A gal-septing bullfrog, Jenny. A word from one of our sponsors.
Kids, time to get back to Gilbert and Frank's Amazing Colossal Podcast. So, let's go.
And now back to the show.
We haven't talked enough about Joe Flynn.
Go ahead. Okay, Joe Flynn, and really only Gilbert and I are appreciative of Joe Flynn, is the reason that we get residuals for TV shows.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yep.
Ah. Cool.
Yep.
He fought for them?
Huh. Yes, he's the one. He was either SAG president or he's the one who campaigned, and he's the reason why.
And I heard both Boris Karloff and James Cagney were very big on the early Screen Actors Guild, like actors' rights. Oh, I
didn't know that. And so was Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, Ronald Reagan. Yeah. About unions and stuff.
Are you aware, Richard, do you know that if a writer, a screenwriter, creates a character for a TV series.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he gets it.
It's wonderful. If you create a character for an episode and they say, wait, we like this character, Georgette on Mary Tyler Moore, came in like year three, two, something like that. If you wrote that episode, you get a little taste of every episode that character appears
That's
forever.
Great.
That's a wonderful thing.
Oh, no. The best was Matt Williams, who created Roseanne. Okay, and about the third or fourth episode, he comes in. They used to have a 5 o'clock show and a 7 o'clock show. The 5 o'clock show doesn't do well. And he comes into the green room in between shows and he goes, tonight's episode was terrible. And the reason is you, and points at Roseanne. Well, he was never on stage again and got money every single show because he created the show, and he was never allowed on the line.
Wow.
So how about that? And I'll tell you, here's one that's even worse, although it's not a nasty thing. I want to say Brett Ratner, who wrote The Amazing Ducks, or the
Amazing Mighty Ducks.
The Mighty Ducks. Okay, whoever wrote that or directed it gets money from Disney because of the hockey team in Anaheim, the Anaheim Ducks. He gets money simply because he wrote the movie.
And
how about that, huh?
Gene Roddenberry, he made sure to write lyrics for the theme to Star Trek. No one's ever seen or heard these lyrics. He wrote them whenever they played the Star Trek theme. He made residuals.
That's what Carol O'Connor did. Right. Harold O'Connor suddenly decided that
the family should have lyrics
called Remembering You.
Right. Yes.
I'm remembering you. After the show had been on.
The closing theme.
Yeah, the opening theme was written by Charles Strauss and Lee Adams.
That's right.
And the line that no one could ever understand was,
G.R.O. LaSalle ran
great. They had to re-record.
Yeah.
They re-recorded it, and people still couldn't understand.
And you know what was funny? When they re-recorded it, it was so funny. Forced. It like
slows down.
Great.
We don't care that much.
LaSalle.
All right, this is the perfect.
Wait. Do you have a bottle? Because I got to pee.
Hang on to that, Rich, because this is a perfect segue because we're talking about TV themes.
Can we announce that Mike Weber.
Michael Weber.
The screenwriter, he's nominated.
Disaster artist.
He said, and he did, attend the Academy Awards, and on the lapel of his tuxedo, he wore an orange peel pin.
Yes. Or an orange wedge.
An orange wedge.
Yes.
An orange wedge.
In tribute to this show.
Yes.
That's how far it's come.
That's how far
a ridiculous urban myth.
Hashtag Cesar Romero.
That's it.
Cesar Romero used to have orange wedges flung at his head.
You guys want to go out on some, try to name some TV themes from the 60s and 70s?
I don't want to go out. I want to continue. I got to go to the bathroom.
Just one thing about Joe Flynn.
Pause for a second.
All right. Okay.
Okay. Do you mind?
No, and then we'll wrap it up.
Jeez.
Did you wash your hands? Because I see you're about to drink a beverage. No, I'm kidding.
You guys need a nap.
I know where I've been.
I just peeled an orange. If anyone would like to drop your hands.
You got to throw
By the
it.
Way, I was smart enough
you gotta to start
to,
throwing
to,
them.
To eat my orange over here so that the audience had that to hear.
Very respectful.
It was.
Very professional.
It was.
Oh, are we still recording?
Really? You can clean up orange?
Well, you're all on different mics, so I mean, I got to do a lot of going in. And like when you're not talking, you do.
We haven't brought up.
All I've seen you is on the phone. Whenever I'm here, you're always like on the phone with playing word games.
Pictures.
It'll only take about 9 hours to edit.
I promised everybody on Facebook we'd be discussing Milton Berle at least, you know, a tiny bit.
I want to know about Milton Berle's son. One of you must know.
Well, was it that comedian? Was it?
He says it's a comedian. He said he had a comedian.
The guy who produced Courtship of Eddie's Father. The guy,
James Comack.
That was a strong rumor.
Comack?
Yeah. James Comack.
He was, by the way, brilliant on a TV series that no one remembers that I love called Hennessy, starring. I can see even you don't. Remember.
I know who it is. But the child actor, Jackie Cooper.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, and that's right.
And Abby Dalton.
It was
Roscoe Carnes. I know Abby Dalton very well.
Irving Brecker made that show. In
Milton Berle's autobiography,
I love her.
He says that he ran into some really successful director.
Right.
And the director wanted to talk to Milton Berle about doing something with him. And he brushed them off, and he said, and then afterwards he found out that this great director was his son. And he said, and that was my chance. And I thought, what the fuck do you mean? You could have called him up.
He keeps that theme throughout that entire book. His autobiography, like, you know, he alludes to it early and midway, and then towards the end he finally meets him. It's like it's a producer director, and then there was strong speculation it was James Comack because they look alike too. And Berle might have been around 16 when Comack was born, so that's a little tricky.
Is Comack still alive?
No, he's gone.
He's gone.
And I always say,
he's great in Hole in the Head.
I remember Comack, the name Comack, and whenever I hear about Toback, I always. Think of guy.
It's but like, the proof would be if Comack had a giant cock, then you know we would know.
And nobody.
I think James Comack in the movie of Damn Yankees is the one singing, or lip syncing.
He's in it. Yeah, he's in that movie.
He's in Hole in the Head. He's the guy with the hula hoop.
Hole in the Head too.
I think he's the one who, that's the money notes in You Gotta Have Heart. Whoever gets to sing You Gotta Have Heart.
That's him. You guys want to try this?
Yeah. And but even though they look nothing alike. People were suggesting, because you say big director,
yes.
People always go, oh, Steven Spielberg. No. So it started a semi-rumor that Steven Spielberg is the son of Milton Berle.
I'd like to think that's true.
You want
to
try some Berle theme song skill?
No.
Okay, good.
He has
can we, I have a, because this is the 200th.
Yeah.
And my guess is you listen to all of these shows, yes?
You're the only one.
No.
Am I the only one?
You are.
You're the only one.
Yeah.
I really am. Huh?
Pretty much.
Okay, I listen to Craig. You know, I have an announcement, actually. You know, I don't want to break. I don't want to burst the bubble. And
right.
But Richard Kind is not actually here. It's actually Craig Bierko. Somebody had to say it.
Craig Bierko is doing the imitation review. And
Craig, would you, you know.
Who's from The Simpsons who does a great you?
Dan Castellaneta.
No, but the other one.
Hank Azaria.
I've seen him do you fabulously.
Yeah.
Gilbert, do you do Richard?
Craig Bierko did an imitation of you where he was saying, like, and.
I heard
and it. And my friend George Clooney.
Oh, yeah. I don't like that. Okay.
He's done that many times.
Somebody said, oh, I bet Craig is the only one. So many people do an imitation of me, and I can't do it except for this, because this is how Hank got it, is they said, can you play? And I was guesting on a show called The Commish, and they go, can you play poker next Monday? And I go, I can't. I'm doing a commish. And that's the only way that's the only imitation.
Who does the best one?
Dan probably.
Dan.
Does the best. And we did one. We were at Second City together, and we did one where I'm coming in as a sperm donor for his wife. And Isabella Hoffman is on stage. So I meet Dan, and Dan is doing me the whole scene. I go, how are you? And he goes, I'm fine. How are you? And we're wearing the same shirt. And we're doing, we like play charades. And it's like, who is Hieronymus Bosch?
Mercy Hump.
I do a great old Larry Fine. Can I do that briefly?
Yeah.
Because I got a request earlier for that.
Okay.
All right.
Mo, where's Curly Joe?
Pretty good.
I heard he was in the kitchen making flapjacks.
That's it.
Pretty good.
Dan Castellaneta was doing the voice of the genie after Robin was pissed at Disney. Because he felt they screwed him in the first one. And in Return of Jafar, and then in the series, they had an Aladdin series, and Dan Castellaneta was
the
genie.
Did that work? Was it good? Or was it like Mel Blanc when he tried to do Elmer Fudd, and you always knew it was shit that Arthur Hugh Bryan had died?
That's right.
You could tell. Like the guy they brought in to do the second Fred Flintstone, it just was never the same. Yeah.
You know? Well, he wasn't doing like an out-and-out imitation of Robin Williams.
Yeah, he was just
so that must have been good.
But yeah, Dan is great. Dan's ridiculous.
Yeah, but he's incredible. he was very funny.
He was so good on Mad About You as the dog walker.
Yeah.
Azaria. Yeah, funny guy.
Yeah. Oh, he's wonderful.
Gil, what do you think?
Okay.
We got a two-hour show here.
Is that true?
No, but
so far?
Oh, I could keep going.
We got more.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, we haven't talked about Francis Bavier's taint yet.
Gilbert claims that Frances Bavier was eaten by her cats.
Yes, I heard that she became a recluse late in life.
Yeah.
And they found her dead body and cats had eaten her.
75 cats.
Yeah, no, Irving. No, Irving cats.
That's the girl.
No.
Who's a pussy
who's the
hound?
Girl it's from true. Attack of the Giant Leeches?
Sandy Dennis?
No. She was a
she had cats too.
Sandy Duncan.
Yvette
Vickers.
Vickers, yeah.
Yvette Vickers. She was found with her cats as a mummy
as
well.
Sad.
And Marie Prevost.
She was a centerfold.
She was
eaten
really
by cats.
Is it sad?
No,
they're dead. Right. They're eaten by their cats.
Celebrities who were dead, like, eaten by their cats.
Dying is sad. And then after they die.
Did anybody eat? Did any of Lewis Stone's cats eat him when he died? I don't think it got to that. Tragic enough. We were talking earlier about celebrities who died on stage.
You know, yes.
Frank Sutton.
Dick
Sean's the famous one.
Dick Sean.
And Joe Flynn.
I didn't know about Joe Flynn.
Three.
I forget.
I don't know
shows.
About.
And Cary Grant died preparing to go on.
That's right.
Preparing. I was going to
really?
Mention.
Really?
He only got two Judys out. And then
I saw Bert Lahr's last performance, which was at the Tappan Zee Playhouse in Nyack, New York. He was doing Never Too Late, the Paul Ford vehicle. And he died the next day. That's I've never.
And
did he choke on a Lay's potato chip? Is that how he?
Say again?
Did he choke on
Carmen Miranda?
Jack Gilford with the cracker jack. Though. That was a terrible thing.
I think Carmen Miranda died immediately after
in her dressing room.
Oh, did she? Right.
Yeah. She went back to the dressing room.
I can understand that.
And of course, park your carcass.
I saw Dori Sarry passed away. I saw him the night before he died. He gave a lecture somewhere I was, and then he died the next day. But I can understand somebody putting out that much and then...
it's terrible to watch Jerry Lewis run up those stairs in Cinderfella.
Oh, my God,
because he makes it to the... It's this wild take where he's going...
Yeah.
And he gets to the top of the stairs and runs off. And the next day, you read that he had had a heart attack and was laid up for, like, forever.
Well, how about a Park Your Carcass?
I just said that. Yeah, Albert Brooks' father.
And do you know how they found out about it? Which I've said on this show. I'm sure I have. Was it they woke up and were listening to the radio and found out that...
That's how Albert and his brother found out?
His brother found out that they're dead.
And Albert had helped him with his material that night. Oh, and was like, and that. It was a great memory he has. The last time he saw his dad, he helped him. And Parky Carr, you've probably heard the tape. He was great that night. He was funnier than George Burns and Milton Berle and Desi Arnaz and Tony Martin. He really did. Well,
and,
killed
and
himself.
They said Desi Arnaz, you know, when they found out he was dead... Desi Arnaz, left the stage crying. Oh.
That was the final nail in the coffin of the Lucy-Desi marriage, because they were still married when they did that. The roast was a Lucy-Desi roast in the late 50s, and they divorced soon after that.
You know? Too traumatized by the death of Parky Carcass?
Wait, you're trying to make a correlation. Is that what you're doing?
I think so.
I don't think so. And I adore you. Having just met you, I adore you. Always
and
loved you. I think
Bob,
you're wrong.
Bob Einstein, who's the son, him and Albert Brooks, the sons of Park Your Carcass. Bob Einstein, they said, one time someone said to him, and they said, well, isn't it beautiful your father died doing what he loved? And Bob Einstein said to him, he said, what is your mother doing? He goes, she's a housewife. And he goes, let's go over to her house now. And while she's doing the laundry, I'll take out a gun and blow her fucking brains out. And we can say she died doing what she loved.
When I met Albert a couple years ago, he said, because I've done books on Jewish comedians, old Jewish comedians. He said, how come he didn't include my dad? I said, he never got old. He died in his 40s. I said, I'd love to. But Albert now is in his late 60s, and, if I do another book, I'll include him.
Right. Now, because you mentioned Desi Arnaz, have I said this, or have you ever heard the story about when Lucy walks in on him getting a blowjob?
Oh, no.
Yeah. Oh, this is the greatest. This is the greatest. Desi, who was a womanizer, is getting a blowjob in his dressing room or something. And Lucy walks in, and Desi looks down and goes, what are you doing?
Great. Do we know who that woman might have been? Was it Ethel?
Now,
Mrs. Trumbull.
I guess I'll have to write.
Did you ever hear this, when Steve Rossi tells a story getting a blowjob from Mae West? In the 50s?
Jackie Martling told
us. Yeah, that's great.
And then, her teeth is still on his cock after, she like...
And he was holding her wig, and she's there with her bald head.
Right. That could have been my Katharine Hepburn.
Again, something I should draw, right?
As we wind down, anybody got any plugs? Drew, you want to plug the book?
Well, my latest book is Drew Friedman's Chosen People, and two of the chosen people are Gilbert, and then there's a portrait of you, Frank, that book. And I swear to God, I'm going to draw you guys now that we've met. You have perfect faces for me, which is a compliment.
Richard?
I was on a show called Spin City. I got nothing.
Frank, could you ask one question that you prepared?
Yeah, one question that you prepared. I wanted
Unfortunately, they all start big conversations.
Oh.
Can we get to my plug, please?
Yeah, let's get to Rupert's plug.
Get one in. I feel bad.
Okay, this was Richard's idea. Quickly, a movie that affected your life.
Say affected not the way you watch movies, but how you view the world. What really changed you? Because I don't know whether or not movies or art can
do
that.
I would say Skidoo was the life changer for me.
Yeah,
you know, it was like
when you went into the priesthood.
What the fuck? You know, it's like one of those films. It's like
to ask Groucho why he did Skidoo?
Groucho, why did you appear in Skidoo?
Because Chico needed a man.
Chico had died 10 years before. That's not working.
Rupert, your box set.
Oh yeah,
which you were kind enough to send.
You've been very kind to say very nice things about my first albums, and they've just been brought out again in a three CD set.
Songs that sound like movies.
Songs that sound like movies. Cherry Red is the record label out of the UK, and if you go to RupertHolmes.com, there's a link there that'll take you to Cherry Red.
Are these songs that you wrote or that you?
These are songs that I wrote and recorded.
First three albums.
And my first three albums and the first album is the one that when Barbara Streisand heard it, she called me up on the phone. I didn't know her from anything. And she said, I like these songs. I want to record them. I see you do your own arrangements. Why don't you fly out? I'm also working on a movie called A Star Is Born. Maybe you'd like to write some of the songs for that. And this is all from, like, my first album. So,
if you love movies.
Yeah. Richard, what movie affected your life?
I mean, this will get into a serious talk.
That's
but it was the movie MASH. Mm. I learned what irony was. I learned war was bad. I learned I wanted to be a guy like these guys, and I wasn't. Believe me, it took me many years.
And you got to see Sally Kellerman naked.
And I saw Sally. That brings us back. Okay. I saw Sally Kellerman naked. It taught me a lot, and I wanted to be these guys. I wanted to be Elliot Gould. It had an effect on
Robert. Robert Duvall was in that. He was great.
But I didn't want to be Robert Duvall.
You killed him.
You want to hear my Robert Duvall story?
Yes.
Okay. My dad says to me one time when I'm much younger, he goes, "Son, did you ever see the movie Tender Mercies with Robert Duvall?" And I go, "Yeah." And he goes, "Why can't you act like that?"
Rupert.
Oh, I don't know. North by Northwest changed my life. It made me think what movies could do to you. Just the effect. I saw it, blessedly, I saw it at Radio City Music Hall, first run, and I had just come from being at the UN, so all the scenes at the UN felt like they had been filmed for me. And I never saw anything be so constantly entertaining and interesting and adult all the way through. And even Marie Saint looked good then, as she does now. A Face in the Crowd with Andy Griffith.
One.
And Walter Matthau.
Walter Matthau, Lee Remick.
And Lee Remick, when she bends over backwards as the cheerleader. That changed my life for that
Tony, Tony Franciosa, yep. First film.
Yep. In A Face in the Crowd, there's one part where he finds out Tony Franciosa's fooling around with Lee Remick.
Right.
And he wants to fire him. And Tony Franciosa says to him, he goes, he tells him how, they're working together. There's no way he can fire him now. It's too late. And he goes, "You're in bed with me, lonesome, in bed."
Fantastic
That's
movie.
Great.
You have a favorite film, a film that changed your life?
I can't really think of one.
Was it that woman falling off the dolphin?
The what? Oh, yes!
It was a short subject.
Film at 11.
I had so many films that I loved.
Frank, what was yours?
Oh, God. I got to think about that. I just for a bonding experience with my dad, and I never had any. The Great Race, Blake Edwards, The Great Race.
Oh, yeah.
Larry Storch?
Yeah, that was a movie we had in common.
Professor Fate.
That's it, Jack Lemmon, Chewing the Scenery.
Wow. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm very fond of that one.
Oh, I went to see It's a Mad, 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 Mad World with my dad, who had recently had some sort of operation, and it was on a Sunday afternoon. Actually, it was a Sunday afternoon, and he just kept getting up for 3 hours, just walking up and down the aisle. He couldn't stand it, and that's what I remember.
Gilly?
Yeah, never mind.
Okay, we should wrap now.
Or it's a three-hour show.
And this has been Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast with my co-host Frank Santopadre. And we've had our return guests, Rupert Holmes, Richard Kind, and Drew Friedman.
Can I say something?
No.
You did that without looking at a piece of paper. You knew our names.
Yes.
You knew our names.
Yes.
This is fantastic.
Is that first?
That's fantastic.
I was amazed as I was doing
it. He had 3 hours. He had 3 hours to figure out who we were.
How the fuck did I do that?
<It's amazing.
laughs> Thank you, gentlemen.
Charm that's a joy.
At a loon with a face like a goon.
If they jail, that the public will yell. That's entertainment.
Well, I recall I was nothing at all.
I must confess, I was probably less.
We were fair, but now since we're a pair. Come what comes, Jerry boy, we will be.
As anybody can see,
our friendship just fills us.
At times it almost kills us.
Or the team.
Yeah, what about the team?
That began as a dream.
Thanks to you, is a dream that came true. It's not smart, but it's straight from the heart.
Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast is produced by Dara Gottfried and Frank Santapadre, with audio production by Frank Verderosa. Web and social media is handled by Mike McPadden, Greg Pear, and John Bradley Seals. Special audio contributions by John Beach. Special thanks to Paul Rayburn, John Murray, John Fotiatis, and Nutmeg Creative. Especially Sam Giovanco and Daniel Farrell for their assistance.